Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Beady, beady, beady. Okay, Buck.
And Justin Robert Young.
Hi, friends. It's me.
You got to do Mr. Theopolis.
Oh, wait. Is that the dude who was wearing what's his name?
Twiggy the robot. Yep. Had the little electronic brain. It was they're basically
their. And by the way, Twiggy wearing the electronic brain. He was like my generation's Flavor Flav in 1977. You know, it was amazing.
So we're talking, of course, about Buck Rogers, the 1970s, early 80s show, I believe, and they had a little robot Twiggy whose head looks suspiciously like
a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah, we'll describe it as that.
And then, it was very mushroom shaped.
Yeah,
I see what you're going for now. It took me the longest time to realize that, you know, because Dr. Theopolis was the one that was chatting all the time. Twiggy was just kind of dumb
cosplaying as Twiggy. That was cool.
What's that?
There was a little person cosplaying as Twiggy.
Isn't that the actual actor?
No, it's a person cosplaying.
Oh, sorry. I don't want to break the illusion, but I was always confused. Like, I was like, there was Dr. Theopolis spent so much time talking that I just assumed, oh, it's like a symbiote thing. And then when Twiggy would butt in with his helpful stuttering, I was like,
Mel Blanc doing Twiggy.
What's that?
I think that was Mel Blanc.
Oh, really?
Twiggy. Oh, wow. You're right. It was. Mm-hmm. Huh.
Right ago, Buck. Yeah. Anyhow, we digress.
Real quick, before we move on, this is one of the few times I get to mention this crossover. Justin and I, at Dragon Con half a decade ago, went on a quest to get a bunch of people to say science fiction lines that were not in their genre, and we got Buck Rogers to say, "May the Force be with you."
Gil Gerard.
Yeah, Gil Gerard. It was amazing.
That's pretty cool. Were all the Firefly actors really cool?
not so much.
Jewel State was amazing. She was
right,
utterly
sweet.
Delightful.
I hear she's awesome. So, gentlemen, we are this is almost the 50th anniversary of the Kecksburg UFO incident, which was one of the most famous UFO incidents in all of UFO lore. There was a fireball across the sky. December 9th, 1965, it was seen across six states and Ontario, for those of you that are counting. And then it apparently landed in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, 30 miles southeast of Pittsburgh. And there was all sorts of accounts that the military showed up, that they carried away some sort of UFO, and there's even a monument to the crash. It looks a lot like an acorn. People said there was some sort of Egyptian writing. There were even accounts of maybe people saw bodies and stuff. And it's lived on in UFO lore for a long, long time. And it's been, you know, almost up there with Roswell. Kecksburg is, you know, probably referenced lots of times in like X-Files and other stuff. And it's been this, you know, wow, what happened kind of story. And I actually use that as sort of a basis for a short Jessica Blackwood story I wrote called Fire in the Sky, which was just sort of, you know, exploring the explanation behind a lot of those sort of sightings. But I didn't have the explanation behind this one. And now we think we know what happened.
So as the legend is told, can you tell it to us as though Justin and I are bumpkins there in you said this is in what, New Mexico?
Kecksburg, Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. Oh, so northeast. It's colder.
Yeah, the New Mexico.
New Mexico.
Okay, so we'll do the same bit I was thinking of, only we're wearing layers. And there's like a couple of horses drawing a carriage behind us.
So you look up in the sky and you see a bright fireball streaking across the sky. Okay? Other people see this too. You talk to your neighbors. Everybody sees this. Everybody, you pick up the phone. You call a little, you know, Aunt May in the nearby county. Same thing. Everybody's seen this thing. Middle of the night, army trucks roll through your town, right? And go to some distant location outside of the town. And then you see them. They're basically trying to shut everybody down, keep everybody from, you know, the streets or whatever. And then the army trucks come rolling out of town with something covered underneath a tarp, and they won't tell you what happens. In fact, they deny.
This happens when?
What's that?
What time period does this happen?
50 years ago.
1965, 50 years ago.
So this is at the height of, I guess, the beginning of the height of the nuclear scare of the Cold War. And this is my friend Brady tells a story about him going on a vacation in Colorado, and it, in one of the most surreal moments of his entire life, they sit there as they watch something gigantic streak slowly across the sky, and just, you know, and I believe it was a particularly famous, well seen, well documented meteoroid coming in, but they didn't know it at the time, and in a pre-internet age in mid-1980s. The only thing he had to go on was when his dad watched it go across and offered the helpful assessment of, "That's a goddamned ICBM." and so they continued on their vacation, wondering if the world had ended, waiting to find out. But in the meantime, going swimming and so on. I would imagine that it's a similar situation here. At the height of the Cold War, you see a fireball streak through the sky. You think maybe it's a meteor, maybe it's a shooting star, maybe it's some Russian spy equipment, or maybe they're shooting a capsule with some reds.
Want me to run through the theories for you?
Yeah.
So on the slightly more sane, is they thought that there perhaps it was a Russian satellite called the Cosmo 96. In this article I'm reading, it's spelled with a C, but it's actually the K, and there was a lot of that was sort of the claim was, oh, it was this, but people that may have come down on that same night, but that had been debunked by other people, apparently debunked by saying that no, the Cosmos trajectory, which is totally off, it would not have been it because orbital mechanics are very precise. It could not have been that. Then there were some more crazy theories. Some have suggested that it might have been the Nazi Bell, a World War II era experiment related to gravity and time travel.
Okay, so let's talk that one through real quick. Let's say it's just a Nazi artifact in orbit. Wouldn't it be extraordinary for it to have stayed up almost 20 years? Right? Do we have any, Brian, like Skylab didn't stay up that
Brian,
long.
Brian.
Mir didn't stay up that long.
Brian.
Yeah.
Brian.
Yeah.
A Nazi experiment related to gravity and
what, time travel? Oh, so you're saying it just went forward in time is all.
Duh.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Okay. Can we quick sidebar? I almost feel like this could be months of topics for us, because there have to be in published archives, right? Just a litany of like actual like at some point the Nazi stamp of approval got put on a million and a half different kinds of crazy pants ideas. Right.
Yeah. Well, I believe Google calls it 20% time. Yes, where it's exactly. Like, you know, hey man, let's go a little nutty and we'll put the Google logo.
In any situation where obviously far flung military research is at the highest priority, and you have a top down authoritarian system where you only really need to know the predilections of one or two people above you to get signed off on something, you've got to figure. That like, is there any backing to the Nazi Bell? Like, is this an actual thing, or was that just what people thought the Nazis were up to?
I don't know. The first time I encountered the Nazi Bell was 3 minutes ago.
Dude, this is like what's great. This is what a rich
of Nazi experimentation in the world of the weird.
This is
you know, if they stopped all those crazy experiments and focused more energy on winning the war.
Then we would all be speaking
less
German
moon bases,
right now.
You know what I'm saying?
Dude, but think about it. Like from
Nazis on the moon.
From a game theory perspective, this is what you want, right? You want everyone to assume that your reach expands into things like time travel and unleashing hell spirits on Earth and so on.
It's in my business plan. So you run into a problem, too, is that the Cosmos 96 thing, is, I said, apparently been debunked. But one of the problems you have is if we had recovered this Soviet satellite at the time, it would be very much in our interest not to let them know that we have recovered it. You would do everything you could to dispel it, and you would try to, anything you could to discount that. And the problem is that long after the people who did the debunk or the spelling of those rumors or whatever have retired or died, you don't have an oral history, or you don't have a history of what happened. And that's why we some of these things we don't know. We think that some a lot of UFO sightings that we saw, you know, over the United States, many of them could have been surveillance planes from the Soviets. You know, they did flyovers too, and you know, it was not in our interest to reveal to people like, oh yeah, our air defenses aren't quite as tight as we think they are. And if something like that crashed and we had access to a plane or a pilot, it would be in our interest not to let anybody know, etc.
Yeah. That's one of those weird things. It's like in war.
What's the name of the show, Brian, of course.
In war, full stop, you know, when you're at war, kind of all bets are off and everybody does really weird things for their own interest. And they go out of their way to not explain it to the other side, which only makes the Cold War this wonderfully strange 50-year arc in our history where you had everybody diverting all their resources into the weirdest crap possible to poke around on the fringes to see if we're able to spy on the other guy, to launch stuff into space, to drop dummies from various altitudes to take a look. And also, you know, underneath that is this layer of never admit to any of it. The either side, you know, if we have the if we get their downed, you know, fake spacecraft, then we don't say anything and they don't admit that they have it, which only leads, you know, the populace hungry for answers, continuing to pursue weirder and weirder explanations.
I had a friend that worked in the Pentagon, was in the Air Force, actually taught at the Academy. I had him one day tell me one thing, you know, relating to the Iraq War or something like that. And 4 years later, he told me the exact opposite thing. The exact opposite. You know, his position was, oh, yeah, we know blank. And then that, like, no, that was never true. Never acknowledged that he had told me the complete opposite thing.
Yeah.
And stated as this, as his own earned knowledge. Oh, yeah, no, we know this. And then 4 years later, it's like, no, there's no case for that at all. And I'm like, wait, you said.
I've been saying this because you told me.
Yeah, and then like, well, I don't know. Well, that was done, and it's like the other conviction at which it was explained to me, which people, you know, in any environment, especially the military, or you know, I was told this is true, this is what this is, and that becomes so much of, you know, what happens. And I was talking to somebody whose father was like the commander of the watch at one of these military installations, and when you're commander of the watch, you can go anywhere you want, go anywhere in the base, you have complete authority to, but he could not go into the basement of the hospital, and there were two guards there that would not let him have access to there. And that was like, what was going on in there? What was going on in the basement of there? And you could see very much how, you know, for some people, well, that's where they had the aliens. And for me, it'd be like, well, you know, if you had some technicians who were monkeying around with an ICBM and they got exposed to some radiation, that's where I'm going to send them. And I'm not going to tell anybody what the hell's going on. I mean, there's a lot of other causes and reasons you could do that. And so much of what we do in secrecy, there are secrets that we have that we say, yeah, no, a lie is okay. A stupid lie is okay. And that's probably what happened with Roswell, where we had this high altitude listening device that the military is like, well, people want to say UFOs. Sure. And you know, that just leads them further astray from what we're actually trying to do here. In the case of Kecksburg, a compelling theory has come forward as to what it is. It's not Martians, it's Venusians.
Wait, what?
No, I'm making that up. It is a
fiery hot magma beings from the planet Venus have invaded.
The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, 5 decades later, the Kecksburg UFO is identified, parentheses, probably. And this is by Dan Majors. And in it, they speak to a researcher who have come to the conclusion they think what it was a failed launch of a U.S. satellite, that it was a, quote, a General Electric, what was the description?
Electric Mark II reentry vehicle.
Yeah. So it was in the nose cone of Thor, Atlas, and Jupiter rockets, early 1960s. And I think that perhaps that there was some breakup and that thing fell back down to Earth, and that was what the recovery was.
I got to tell you, there was a news story, man, it must have been shortly after. One of the most life-changing things I ever did was take a physics course, Physics 341 at the University of Texas, called Pseudoscience in the Paranormal. And it just changed the way I viewed everything. And it brought this layer of skepticism over everything from late-night infomercials to stories of, you know, astrology and Bigfoot and so on. And on the local news was some guy you know, talking about like, I mowed my farm one day and the next day there was this, and it showed what looked like a giant crumpled, rusted milk can. And he gave that old folksy shrug as he said, you're like, well, you know, it can't come from here, can't come from there, only one place it could come from, and he points at the sky. And I was like, oh, whatever, this guy, you know, it's like he didn't notice. Why would you act like this is some alien stuff? Sure enough, totally wrong. 5 days later, the U.S. government is like, yeah, no, that's almost certainly the second stage of this rocket that we just fired off to send this satellite into orbit. And so it's like, on the one hand, it's tempting for everyone to, you know, just, you know, shrug shoulders and be like, came from aliens up there. But on the other hand, you know, stuff does fall from real government and private institutions, and it's got to end up somewhere.
I have a sneeze I'm trying to suppress. So
okay. I thought I had just blown your mind or something.
I found out. If you were watching the video version, that Andrew's I have an amazing point I want to make face is the exact same as I have a sneeze that I'm holding back.
I was afraid that I feel it just hovering there, and I'm about to talk, and I'm like, maybe it'll happen.
I was afraid I was going to get the, that's the dumbest thing anyone's ever said, Brian.
Well, I was thinking that, Brian.
Of course you did. You always are.
All right. Well, let's take a look at, so this is thought to be an American rocket or, you know, some spacebound craft that has fallen to Earth. You got to wonder, though, you know, with a lot of that Cold War stuff, you know, in just the nature of how things are kept secret, that when that era came and went, you had a lot of files that were just like marked as, you know, as high, very high security clearance. And you got to wonder how much stuff is literally just still there that, like, not only has elements of secrecy just compounded upon people coming in and coming out and just, you know, not, you know, knowing where stuff is or. You know, that stuff just remains secret in a way that maybe it doesn't need to anymore.
There's a lot of stuff that you, if you ask the right questions, you'll get the documents, but nobody knows what the right questions are to ask or where to go to.
Yeah.
So much of that, yeah, is just buried away in these archives, as you point out, that until somebody says, oh, well, can you give me, you know, all of the expenditure reports from, you know, a military base in 1963? And they're like, oh, now I know. And so we don't know what we know. And that was one of the cool things about Raiders of the Lost Ark was – At the very end is the shoving the Ark into the warehouse, because the idea was, what's the best place to keep this secret among all of this other crap?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just bury it amongst, you know, like, finally, the Ark of the Covenant meets its greatest shroud, the United States bureaucracy.
Yes. Now, there's, you know, there are all these interesting stories that I was talking to somebody who was relating that, you know, several astronauts have talked about, like, on their, you know, when they've been up in space or going toward, when we were going to the moon and stuff, things that floated around the windows. And we know now that one is that, you know, it's whatever goes in motion stays in motion. So if you're going to go head in that direction, you have debris and stuff floating around you, it can tend to stay around you. But there are descriptions of things behaving that they thought totally non-Newtonian, they could not describe, whatever. But there can be other principles at play there, you know, weird electrostatic things like that that we haven't even thought about. But then there's the, you know, the idea that, well, maybe it's something else, but, you know, maybe it's not, I don't think we need to go to the explanation of aliens because there's no reason to do that. But we have this idea that sort of there's Earth and then there's the moon, and that's kind of it as far as this part of our solar system, when in fact you have Lagrange points where you have things and collect and debris in there. You have what are called Trojans, which are asteroids that follow sort of a similar sort of path as the Earth does. And so there's a lot of larger debris, but there could be other things. And a very interesting announcement today, which obviously this would not be what anybody saw there, but is that there could be dark matter accumulating behind the moon.
On the dark side of the moon, right?
Yes, on the far side of the moon. Let's call it that.
No, sorry.
The far side of the moon is what the second most popular planetarium plays at midnight on Saturdays.
Well, I mean the side that's dark to us can also be lit.
So real quick, I unfortunately before the show I was talking about there was some story that I thought would make a good thing for Weird Things, and I forgot which story it was and I couldn't find it. However, I announced on Twitter that we're live now recording, and a random fan just sent me a link that blew my mind. Now, I know normally you play the Game Master here, Andrew, but I have a scenario that I'd love to see if the two of you.
Okay,
guys
let me just finish
out.
Up this whole thing about the dark matter.
Okay, yes.
So, a new report, scientists say huge clumps of dark matter may lay just beyond the moon. They predict up to densities of 1 billion times greater than normal. And man, I was in the process of trying to send this link to Bryce, but I'll never win. He'll find it before I click send. He's too good. He's too good. So this is a very interesting observation that we have, dark matter is, sounds kind of
so
cool.
Describe, act like I don't know everything about dark matter here. Just describe to me
let's
what
dark matter
pretend
for just a minute that we don't all have PhDs in theoretical
physics.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm a well-known, a well-respected name on the subject of dark matter, but let's just pretend like I don't know
okay,
crap.
So when you look at a map of, let's say, the galaxy, the universe, and you look at how stars are moving, and you look in the directions that they're going.
Something
appears to be holding things together. There's not enough matter to keep them keep them spread about the rate that they are, which implies that there is something like 70% of the matter is actually matter we cannot see. It's some other form of matter that we're not able to detect, but it has a gravitational influence on all the other matter, because it's just the way when you look at it, say, a galaxy and how it starts to form in its little spiral, right?
Right. So it's like the way I understand it is that a galaxy, you, of course, have a bunch of stars. But if you run a computer model and you plug in like, well, how many stars are there? Well, we know there's this many stars. And how much do each star weigh? Well, they weigh that much or whatever. Let's make a galaxy out of that. And now let's do a model where it spins and spirals. What you get is something fundamentally different from the observed nature of spinning galaxies, right?
Gotcha.
Right.
So there's some tide or momentum that we can't see.
Correct.
With, something that has mass, right? So that's what dark matter is, okay? And that may account for something like, I think, 70% of the matter in the universe is actually dark matter.
Which is problematic when you have to be all like, hey, man, theory of gravity is great, except for it totally doesn't work at all, and we need to correct for it to the tune of like less than half of all the observable matter in the universe accounts for this kind of motion. Like, it's not possible.
Yeah, and the matter would be forming these tendrils or these streams, so it would be this sort of, and that's how they think there might be some tendrils or streams just beyond, where the moon is. And that implies something else entirely, too, is there's this entire web or network of this matter basically combining everything in the galaxy. And then what it gets really weird, though, is you look at how the galaxies are expanding away from each other. And you're saying, well, wait, what's going on there? And that's when dark energy comes into play. And that's this other force, which is pushing things on a larger scale apart. And that's something like 99% of the universe is this dark energy, which we can't see.
That's the one I've heard explained. That because everything is moving farther apart and the speed at which it's going is increasing over time, there's a number of implications. That's part of the reason that gives credence to the theory that the end of the universe will be in a heat death of the universe, right? Like, everything's going to spread apart, much like a can of Freon. Once it's under pressure inside the can and you press go, everything expands super fast and it gets super cold in your hand. That's essentially what's happening to the entire universe, right?
It's freezing to death.
Yeah.
I can feel it here, Burbank.
Global cooling. You heard it.
Wait a minute. It's gotten real cold around here, like, over the last, like, 2 weeks. This is, oh, man.
Let's do our sponsor talk.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. It might be. The universe might be cooling to the point where we're all going to die, but you can keep us warm at night and yourself as well with the Weird Things Patreon. Head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. You can support the show. Thank you to everybody who made November so awesome. As per usual, we see some folks reshuffling some of their donations. But if you would like to become a part of Team Weird Things, head on over, patreon.com/weirdthings. It gives us the ability to not only pay for Bryce Neshcom Castillo, who is our amazing Google Foo producer that keeps everything up there on the screen, but also gives us a little discretionary income to spend on the show when we need it. So head on over, patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah, man, only $68 away from that wonderful $666 per episode number. We had it for one whole week, people. Let's get back there. Hey, so I have a real life scenario for the two of you guys.
Okay.
I want you to imagine that you guys are standing in line waiting to watch the new Star Wars film, The Force Awakens.
That one.
I don't know if you heard of it. All of a sudden, a couple of helicopters appear overhead. First, you guys are cheering because you think that, you know, it's some kind of tie-in marketing thing. Then all of a sudden, some Spec Ops MI6 people drop down, and they put bags over your head.
But
they knock you out
because they're MI6 and British.
Well, okay. Actually, they're MI8 now that you said that. So fine. Oh. Yeah. Don't make me take them to MI12 because they will go there. you guys get knocked out, and you wake up. And there's we'll say he's German. German dude with
the Germans?
The circular glasses. And he says, we have a mystery, gentlemen. And only you can solve it. He says, and
Does the accent keep going in and out?
Yes, he does. He's also wearing flip-flops and a Hawaiian shirt. And behind him, stoically, is the actor who played TC, Magnum P.I.'s buddy who flew the... who flew the helicopter.
How old is he?
I don't know. He's really old, but the German guy looks old in that old German guy kind
Sorry,
of way.
I'm not hearing into this. I've already left the building and running back to the theater.
No, you're on a helicopter. You can't go anywhere. And
that does not stop Andrew. Andrew runs right off the helicopter like a lemming.
And then he says, we need you to explain this. And he opens up the door of the helicopter, and you're, I don't know, maybe 300 feet up, looking out on this field of crops, and you see dozens of crop circles. Now, these look very similar to crop circles the way you're picturing them, but they're a little bit sloppier than you see, like, on the cover of a Led Zeppelin album. What do you say, gentlemen?
Sloppy crop circles?
Sloppy crop circles.
Are these like just circles or I mean, because like the thing that makes a crop circle feel like it's something that's intelligent is the fact that it has a higher degree of precision. It's not just a circle. It's a thing that's like lines within lines within lines. Or are these just sort of disc shaped?
They're much closer. They're much closer to just being disc shaped, and even then they're sloppy at that. They're circular patterns.
Discish.
Yeah, they're more like disc circles.
Yeah.
So, you know, my first instinct would be animal. So, like, if you go to a lake, you know, there's like lakes in Florida where if you go look, you'll see these round dome like things in the water, these sort of like depressions, these round circular depressions. And what it is, there's a fish that will get in there, swim around and like put its eggs and swim around in sort of a circle and make basically which like looks like a sand crop circle. So, if I saw this thing, I might be thinking, you know, like, I don't know. Is there, do I get to inspect it? Do I get to see if there's some sort of animal presence there or something?
Very good, Mr. Main.
First things first. Hey, German, what are you even doing? Like, hey, we're trying to go see Star Wars right now. Really inappropriate and rude to drug us and put us on a helicopter. Number two, TC, love your work. Number three, how is this even something that you need to bring us in for? There's a million very, very well understood reasons why crop circles happen. And if these aren't more ornate or do anything to disprove or not suggest that the well-documented way that people create crop circles is not, the case, then I don't know what we're doing on this helicopter.
Very well spoken, Mr. Young. Unfortunately, we know it's not made by people. We know it's made by an animal. We need you guys to figure out the animal that created these circles and the reason for having done so.
It's a snake. Because he wanted
it. It's always a snake. Because weird things.
I'm trying to remember if we covered something like this before where it was an animal that was leaving...
Organic, like, see from the air crop circles?
Yeah, what kind of field is this?
It's a crop... That It's a crop.
Is this something that's getting some animal high and it's just rolling around in the ground and circles?
I mean, it's used for medicine. It's a medicine field.
So is this like a cannabis crop or something?
No, goodness. No.
No, it's poppies.
Very good, Mr. Young.
Yeah. You have... So something's getting high and rolling around in the ground.
But we need to know which animal it is.
There's only one animal German person in TC that could be possibly capable of consuming such raw opiates and rolling around with such power. Somebody find out where the Rolling Stones are on tour right now. I will guarantee you that Keith Richards has been there overnight.
If it's poppy fields and it's in, if it's not Southeast Asia and it's more in the Middle East, I would say it'd be like sheep, are the ones that would be doing it, would be getting high and sort of rolling around.
All right. So Andrew's guess is sheep in the Middle East. Justin, what about you?
Wait, do we not get to know where this is?
Yeah, you could ask.
Where is this?
Where are we?
Yeah. Perhaps the reason for my terrible German accent is because I'm Australian, mate.
Oh, kangaroos.
Yeah, man. Wallabies. It's wallabies. Yeah. Wallabies getting wicked high, running around in circles, stomping out crop circles in poppy fields. How amazing is that?
All right, just read the last two lines of that bolded lead there, Brian.
Australian wallabies are eating opium poppies and creating crop circles as they hop around, quote, as high as a kite, a government official has said.
There we go. That's what I needed. I just need as high as a kite.
Is that a government official? I stumbled across the image when we were talking to about Tez on Night Attack the other day, but it's like in my mind, every time an Australian talks, it's always between mouthfuls of wasps that they're eating. That's amazing. High as a kite.
All right, so a wallaby went crazy and is just like, but I mean, I guess that's but nobody was mistaking this as like, a crop circle thing, right? Like, were they? Is that how it was found out? Or was somebody like, man, my heroin crop is ruined. Damn you, wallabies.
So this is the Attorney General for the island state of Tasmania had to give a testimony to Parliament during a parliamentary hearing on security for poppy crops, because poppy is, of course, made for medical stuff. They make, make morphine and so on. And so in her testimony, she said, quote, between mouthfuls of wasps, she said, the one interesting bit that I found recently in one of my briefs on the poppy industry was that we have a problem with wallabies in entering poppy fields, getting high as a kite and going around in circles. Laura Giddings told the hearing, quote, then they crash, she added. We see crop circles in the poppy industry from wallabies that are high.
And the sharp needles they leave around there, too, are really problematic.
It's really unhygienic when you think about it. And actually,
hopefully
to your point,
connected, the trend of junkies dressing in wallaby costumes.
Rick Rockliffe, who has the most Australian name ever, a spokesman for poppy producer Tasmanian Alkaloids, said the wallaby incursions were not very common, but other animals, and this is giving you a high five here, Andrew, have been spotted in the poppy fields acting unusually. There have been many stories about sheep that have eaten some of the poppies after harvesting, and they all walk around in circles, he added. That's amazing, dude.
And then I think we need to figure out some sort of intervention from this. You know, first you get the poppy addiction. Great, we're going to get some good music. I mean, I'll be honest with you. You know, yeah. We're going to get our own kind of Australian jazz and some other stuff coming out of there.
By the way, I do have to give a tip of the hat to Lovely Metalhead on Twitter for hitting us up. She's in the chat right now. That is a fantastic story right up our alley.
By the way, Lovely Metalhead, who has been around podcasts that I've done dating back to the Chris Angel Report days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, wow. No, big shout out to Lovely Metalhead.
So I wanted, I'm trying to, it's an article I want to cover, but I want to kind of go to like, go straight to the source first here. And I'm trying to figure out, entertain yourselves, gentlemen.
That's fun. Hey, real quick, now's as good a time as any for us to say that if you head on over to Google, one of our very own has an amazing project that he's working on that he's finally able to take public. Your friend of mine, Jaime Ruiz, a.k.a. Tensor Guy in the chat, has been working for, what, nigh 2 years now, Justin, on this this display?
Oh, yeah, no, in various incarnations and very seriously, you know, over the last year. But, yeah, just go ahead and Google Holovect Volumetric Display, H-O-L-O-V-E-C-T. In fact, you could probably just you know, Google that, and you're going to find it right there on Kickstarter.
It's good SEO, man.
What was that?
Oh, it's good SEO. There ain't no other Holovect for you to compete with when you type that in.
Certainly not, man. So go ahead and check it out. It is a fascinating creation and Tensor Guy. Listen, I mean, even in this episode right now, you have seen him down in the chat room, his name providing some of the most amazing and insightful commentary on this and so many other shows that we've done. Go ahead and check it out. It really is unique and something that you got to get your eyes on.
For those of you guys audio only, this is the beginning steps of truly the fantasy. You know, we've watched science fiction, we've seen volumetric displays, everything from Iron Man to Avatar to the Return of the Jedi. To you name it, this idea of a projectable 3D volumetric display has been very, very difficult. And the reason it's difficult is because you know people are treating it as a problem that has to use a lot of processing power. And from what little I've seen of this in person, Jaime Tensor Guy has figured out a way to get a volumetric display in vector format using very, very little processing power. There's not a lot for it to do. You're able to have a fairly low-powered CPU, and yet it's true. It starts with a dot. The first time I saw it, and there was a single dot floating in midair, but it was able to move on the X, Y, and Z axis. It had true 3D movement. And once you can make a dot, you can spin it back and forth to make a line or a vector. Once you can make a line, you can make pretty much anything. And that's what he's trying to do with his Kickstarter. Just Google Holovect. And if you want to throw some money his way, you can. Or if you can buy one of those for yourself, then you could be part of the revolution. It's a 3D technology that does not require any kind of standing in the right spot, wearing goggles, or none of that nonsense.
Check it out. Holovect, H-O-L-O-V-E-C-T.
Gentlemen.
Yes.
All right. So, yeah. All right. But what's up, bro?
Oh, you know, no big deal. Other than apparently, I don't know if you guys got the news because I think it was a slow news week. So, you know, they didn't cover the huge entrance to massive underground alien UFO base found on Mars in Google Maps, says UFO hunters.
Blah, 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 blah. What's funny is you say that, and I expect that to be your hilarious interpretation of a civilized headline, and yet here we are looking at Inquisitor.com, and the headline definitely says, huge entrance to massive underground alien UFO base found on Mars in Google Maps, says UFO hunters. So
here we go. Inquisitor, the old gray website.
The old gray wizard.
The old gray wizard.
Okay, so we're looking right now via Google Earth at Mars, and I assume we're going to find a coordinate and zoom in on it.
So here we go. We are zooming in now to the surface of what?
All right. Yeah.
So
okay.
Here's what I would describe as what we're looking at. I will describe for the audio listeners amongst the surface of Mars. And again, this is a fairly crude rendering of it in Google Earth. You have what looks to be a solid three lines of a solid entrance. It has almost a metalish kind of frame around it. One side is still the Earth. But it effectively just looks like Final Fantasy II level graphics of like where you would walk in to get a new map.
It does. It looks like to represent a garage. They just photoshopped most of a garage on there. But the problem, as we scroll around, is that the entire, all the imagery is a patchwork. And as a patchwork, we've got all of these square artifacts all over the place.
So here we go. We're zooming in again. The first two that we saw looked the same. By the way, this video is called Sensational Discovery, Martian City, ?
Man, we really do live it. I thought yellow journalism was bad. Now in the clickbait era, it's
this is red journalism at this point. Now it looks like we see the bottom two parts of what had been obscured. Now in on either side of what looks to be a bit of a wasteland.
Oh, I didn't realize we weren't looking at the actual Google Earth. Somebody has recorded a video walking through it. Yeah. Can we hear a bit about what they're claiming?
Nope.
Oh, of course not.
Just a lovely little pad.
Synth pop. He's just going to be like, relax. Imagine yourself.
But there are multiples of these like corner pieces that he's pointing out.
Okay.
Right now.
So, before we get to what this is almost uncertain, like, almost certainly, let's make our best case. Andrew, how does this prove that there's a gigantic Martian underground city?
I mean, I'm sure the skeptics out there are going to point out the fact that these imaging systems are filled with all sorts of artifacts and sort of data things that tend to take on what look like sort of regular repeating sort of bits of information. And we saw before there's a really cool example of all the different tool impressions we've made, which this is obviously not. And so I say, instead of just jumping to the logical conclusion that it's probably an artifact or some sort of data thing that, you know, happens to this data, because I don't really understand or know how these things are really compiled, I think we just got to accept it at face value and say that it's a UFO base.
Well, and more importantly, we have to figure out who's making the money to Photoshop out all of these obvious square holes in the Martian surface.
Yeah. And let me be clear, like, I'm the guy that can't figure out how to get the coordinates to work in the Google Earth for Mars.
Yeah, so no matter what, the creator of this video has already beaten, if Andrew Main and the skeptics are so smart, why can't they make Google Earth work? all right, so, I mean, yeah, the idea here being that there are underground structures with vents that are leading out, right? So I guess either craft can get out. I don't know why they would be open like that.
It's got to be bored.
In my defense, by the way, I can't even plug the coordinates that they show. This is how you do look for something into the search box and get it to work. So
yeah.
I mean, it's got to be like Borg cubes, right? Where it's like you have these giant kilometer-wide cubes flying around in space, and they got to come back and report back to Mars from time to time. So they come down and they just sort of dock in like giant USB drives where they connect to a global interconnected network beneath the surface.
This is an amazing discovery. And I feel like all of our resources should be looking to send information and salutations directly into these holes on Mars.
I'll show up with two bowling balls and in bags and wearing a Hawaiian shirt with TC from Magnum PI.
Oh, man.
So I'm going to leave this as a mystery. Gentlemen, want to do picks?
Yeah. But before we do, though, let's talk about how interesting is it that, you know, pareidolia. There's two words.
Pareidolia
is the tendency to see faces and stuff, right? There's another word that means seeing shapes and amorphous other things. But it's like we already have that built into us. We want to make a signal out of noise. And now, man, oh, man, do we have a lot of noise to work with. Everything from, you know, in the early 2000s, EVP was a big deal, as both Andrew Main and I wrote routines about. But nowadays, we have the noise of the entire map of alien worlds. We have genuinely alien places, which is why
I have a friend that after that last launch that looked really spooky and weird, you know, he's like, yeah, I've been going over the footage, and he works in video, and he's like, I've been doing some enhancements and stuff, and I'm seeing some interesting things. I'm like, dude, it's a rocket launch. It's a rocket launch. You know, you have no baseline to compare this thing to. And now he's like, yeah, but or he's like some other footage. Like I'm seeing, and it's like, yeah, you're gonna see things that you're not gonna understand or recognize if you do freeze frame grabs or you enhance stuff or whatever. You're gonna get artifacts. You're gonna get stuff. And if you just keep looking hard enough, you're gonna find something that, you know, creates something that looks like it's a shape or something, but it ain't.
Yes. Apophenia. APOPHENIA is the
a lesser known Queen album, but it was still
general
quite
cool. Category of seeing patterns in random data. Apophenia.
Apophenia.
Apophenia. Whatever. Apophenia.
I would like for this to be the entire podcast. It's just trying to get that word right.
I think that's probably part of the uphill battle of being a skeptic is all these terms are really hard. And they're like, well, that's clearly a type one error, not a type two error.
Where is that? Oh, as we all know, those two types of apophenia, paradolophenia.
Aquafina, we're seeing as a possible pronunciation. A pup for Enya.
A plug for Enya?
Papa Felinia. You should probably report that to the authorities.
Sail away, sail away, sail away.
Popcorn fields, yeah.
All right,
is that your pick? Is that disorder?
A poppy field, yeah. No, man, I've got a weird pick this week. It's a book I'm reading, and I can't tell if I like it or not. I find parts of it incredibly trite and obvious, and then other parts I find insightful, and I get surprised by some stuff I didn't know actually happened. The whole book is nothing but hand-wringing about what kind of crimes people are going to come up with thanks to the interconnected nature of the internet. It's a fairly recent book, but the book is called Future Crimes, and I'm listening to the audiobook. It is a big, big, long audiobook, and it's 2 out of 3 stories. It's talking about like, oh, these guys committed a crime, and guess what they used to plan their route? That's right, Google Maps. And how do they know that those people weren't home? That's right, they searched on Facebook. And that half of the book is very tedious and annoying, but occasionally it'll bring up interesting bigger ideas for, you know, when he's at his best when he's thinking up crimes that haven't yet happened but are plausible that would take advantage of stuff. He did do a good job of like explaining, you know, how the U.S. apparently allegedly helped create Stuxnet with the interests of spinning up, messing with the centrifuges in Iran to keep them from being a nuclear player and so on. There's some fascinating stuff, but unfortunately, the smart stuff that surprised me keeps getting washed over by so much eye-rollingly after-school special stuff where it's like, and this person said they were going to a concert, which is why their house was robbed.
It sounds like the person that writes the leads for the evening news.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Find out how Facebook
is the reason. Use every day could lead to your entire life being destroyed. More at 11.
Remember, like, and it was like, I remember, like, 90s where they would always get the B-roll of, like, they'd put, like, a blue light in the room and some kid on a computer. Do you know what your kid is doing in there?
Clickety, 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 clickety.
And it's like this, the glow of the monitors, they're entering some dark web of deceit and stuff. I mean, which we all did, but, you know, hey, got to grow up somehow. Better there than the back of a van. You know what I'm saying? Right?
I hear you, brother.
Yeah, thank you.
So, I mean, this seems to be extraordinarily well reviewed. You know, the Amazon is just a litany and who's who of praise.
I mean, that's why I'm sticking with it. It's just that so far I'm a third of the way through the book, and it's like just so much of it is, and clearly somebody over 30 wondering how those under 30 can just live their whole life in public. And it's like, here's the problem. The problem is, as he describes any crime, you can name some surrogate device or service that was around 30 years ago and make it sound just as awful, where it's like, you know, you could say, you know, before going off to assassinate this woman, these people planned their route using a Rand McNally Road Atlas. And to verify she was home, they even picked up the telephone and called her phone number to see if she would answer.
You know, he hung out by the service station waiting to see which families were filling up with their, you know, grandma's luggage on top. I mean, it just, I don't want to get too nutty here, but like.
Go for it. Let's get nutty. It's weird things.
When it comes to social media, I don't bring my politics to there. I try not to. I try not to bring my politics to there, particularly when some event happens or something like that. That's the worst time to go in there and tell people this is why we need to do X or Y or whatever, because we're emotional. We're
this
reacting.
Is why we need to do X. We're all going to die from murderers.
Or
Y, let's get wicked high.
There are better forms of it. They're much higher grade. Because we're very emotional and we put our stuff in front of other people's faces and stuff like that. And part of the reason is we are driven by emotion. And most people right now, I get in discussions, do not have an accurate picture of, you know, what are the overall violence statistics? They've been declining. They don't know this. They just intelligent people do not know this. And people who don't even watch the news all the time, but who are a little bit more maybe well-read, don't understand these things. And then the things coming out of our mouths are ideas and policies and stuff like that that are maybe come from, you know, ultimately there might be a right point of view, but they're driven by emotion and a lack of understanding of how the world really works and what's been going on. And that's things like books like this and stuff like that. It often seems like it plays into that culture of fear, that idea of and to sell that book, I'm sure this author had to say, let me come up with all these scary scenarios and all these stories about technology, because that's what the editors want. Like, oh yeah, I love that. Yeah, let's really stick it in to show like how this new thing, you know, has all this peril for it. And we become less in touch with how things really work.
Yeah. When I was a young lad, I was once talking to a friend of mine named Andrew Bain. And there's a quote that has always stuck with me about future shaming. The idea that we are kind of talking about of just like, oh, well, it is, which is, it's always our own self-flagellation as humanity, that it's like, look, our advancements are indeed our downfall. And it is, you know, just this very human need to ascribe progress a cost. And that's what all this kind of stuff is. But the quote that Andrew had was imagine the panic years ago that, well, in the future, how grotesque we will become with our search for immortality, that we will have banks of blood, human blood kept, where it should be coursing through our veins. Instead, we'll keep it in a dusty old room so we can chase our need to live longer.
That was based on an actual Newsweek opinion piece at the back of it, which was this guy was talking about the dangers of like his fear of cloning. You know, imagine the horror of, you know, of a room full of brainless bodies serving no other purpose than to provide you tissue. And I'm like, okay, get to the bad part. Get to the bad part. You
yes.
said brainless.
No, definitely. Like from scratch, grow a copy of my body that is perfect, minus the head. Just don't bother to do a head on it. You know, maybe give a brain stem so it could do autonomic functions. A backup liver sounds pretty rad to this guy.
And on that note, one of the really interesting conference that took place this week was not the one in Paris, but it was a group of scientists and bioethicists getting together to talk about the CRISPR technique. CRISPR is the technique that allows, there are two versions of it, one's even more precise than the other, the precision gene editing, like getting down there and figuring out a specific gene, swapping it out with another one, and then also what we call gene drive, which can then mean that every descendant of that person will now have that modification. And it is a scary technology. I do not dispute that at all. But if you look at the quality of life for people who suffer from diseases and conditions that impact them, you know, through the they have with them for the rest of their life. And you think about what is the potential when we can start to eliminate those diseases and give everybody the chance to live a healthy life like, you know, the rest of everybody else. It's a it's an amazing technology. And again, these things need to be approached with rationality. These things need to be approached with sober, intelligent people weighing the options and stuff. But for some people, it's, no, man, dare not go there. I'm like, well, you know, if you have a hereditary disease, maybe you might feel a little bit differently, you know? So.
Yeah, so much of back to this book, Future Crimes, so much of it is just the horror of, you know, don't you realize everyone can see what you're doing in public? Blah, hand-wringing ensues. It's weird. Weird. It's
I mean, this is what I can understand to be frustrating. The quote on the Amazon page from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, their review of it, by the middle of the first chapter, you'll be afraid to turn on your e-reader or laptop, and you'll be looking with deep suspicion at your smartphone. And I mean, like, there are great and amazing and important lessons that we have not have not been drilled into our heads. And there's a reason why everybody should be watching Hack 5 and Threatwire and stuff like that, where people who are very understanding about what the vulnerabilities of our technology, like Darren Kitchen and everybody out there are, can give real world understanding to where you can take actual steps to protect yourself and your family and your identity. But we don't need to pretend like there are demons in the machine or that these things are inherently evil or will only grow more evil the more that we rely on them. They're tools like anything else, and there's ways that you can protect yourself like anything else. Like it just doesn't need to be Frankenstein.
Yeah, I'm with you.
My pick is, once again, Andrew is late to the party.
Oh, yeah.
Last year, I started talking about The Wire. Okay. That was, Andrew, everybody saw that show. I'm like, oh, okay. Cause like, you know, season two is in. All right. Shut up about season two of The Wire.
Yeah.
Now, what is it? What am I on to? It's not The Wire. No, take that off the screen. So, you know, people are like, what? You didn't get in this, even though Brian talked about it? Like, Brian talks about a lot of things. Brian gets excited. Brian's an excitable man, you know. It's in his genes. I at first I'm like, yeah, this is like, there's a lot of cartoons out there. I'm like, yeah, it's kind of in that weird fantasy realism sort of space that like every cartoon exists, you know, and like maybe I'll check it out. And then I checked it out and I watched the first episode, and then I watched the second episode and the third episode, and thoroughly. And now I'm halfway through season two. I'm only letting myself watch one episode a day after I finish my writing, and that is Rick and Morty.
So talk us through the process of discovering it, because I know that, again, like this is part of the reason I value your opinion as a friend, is that you're not easily bullied into joining hype trains on anything. So it means something knowing that, for as much as both, you know, first me shouting at Justin and then Justin getting on the hype train, to have you on the hype train as well is a pretty big deal. How did you end up taking your first taste?
All right, I'm going to let everybody in on Andrew's formula for handling pop culture and media stuff. Is a lot of times people talk about something because it's new and it's different. I'm like, this is new and this is different. It's new, it's different. Oh my God, this is new and different. Everybody talks about it, right? Does that mean it's really great? I mean, it appeals to the novelty-seeking parts of our brain where we want that, but then I wait and see a year later, are people still talking about it? You know, a year later, are people as excited as they were before? And if they are, I'm like, oh, that means it's probably pretty good. There are a lot of TV shows like, oh man, that first episode is great. First couple things, like, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to wait. I'm going to see what if that thing has steam to it. Because sometimes there's a really, really neat premise that just runs out and then there's nowhere else to go.
Which is why Andrew will be seeing Star Wars The Force Awakens 1 year from today.
Yep. There's so much out there. There's so much and so much good stuff out there. And so with Rick and Morty, you know, after season two finished and people are still raving about this, and then I looked at the different groups of people raving about it. You know, like I remember, you know, there was Aqua Teen Hunger Force. I mean, like, oh, it's funny, but it's not like, you know, changed my life funny. You know, I'm like, oh, that's cool. And I thought Archer was really well done, but you know, Archer, I kind of dropped off after Archer Vice, and I'll have to get back into it, you know, and that's, everybody goes through that. But with Rick and Morty was just part of it was just the beats per minute, the amount of creativity that went into that, where you're watching a scene and you look at what's going on in the background, you look at what's going on everything around. So many times I had to stop and rewind just to look at stuff, because it's not like a cartoon where I felt like there was just this 22-second teleplay that they were trying to follow through. There, Justin Roiland and the other writers there are cramming so much stuff into there. I was like, oh my God, this is like so much just happened in the last 3 minutes or whatever. I'm amazed. The complexity of it, and then spoiler alert, you know, the first season, the episode where their reality gets destroyed, so they go into a parallel universe, and Morty has to deal with the sheer horror. Everything has weight. You know, there's not a reset button at the end of every episode. Is that all this is weighing on Morty, and his character is building, and where he's just kind of walking around and he's numb because it's like, yeah, everything you know is gone, and we're just going to step into this other reality and just pretend that didn't happen.
So, speaking fan to fan, I don't know if you heard, but in the second season, I don't know if you've noticed already, but like none of the threads in the second season pick up from the first season. Like there's all these ideas that they just put out there, and that in interviews they said, yeah, when we wrote the second season, it never occurred to us to tie anything into the first season because we just assumed nobody was going to keep watching. And so as a result, as they go into the third season, they're for the first time going back, looking at all these interesting ideas that they sort of set up.
What they did do was second season picked up right after first season. That episode was, there was a bridge there.
Right.
As far as that other stuff, what's the Rick character is fascinating because oftentimes you write a cartoon character and they're just this sort of they're crazy eccentric scientist. It's the crazy eccentric scientist. And then you start to get a realization of this is a guy that's essentially kind of all powerful and has been around, seen everything and all this. He is kind of like the traveler that could give an F. You know, he's kind of like, yeah, I've been there. I've done that. Yeah, I've met 1,000 versions of you. And it's not that he probably started off totally almost. He's not amoral. He's not sociopathic completely. But you see that they're in his own arc, the idea of like, yeah, this guy kind of became this version of himself because of the S stuff he's seen, you know? And I love that. I go, oh, this is the guy that shows up on the beach, you know, after the shipwreck and is like, humanity, you got nothing on me. You know,
by the way, lovely metalhead who submitted that story earlier, apparently made the world's worst drinking game and got super hungover with the rules being sip every time Morty says Rick and Rick says Morty. you're instantly dead by the end of the show.
Believe it. So anyhow, if you have not checked out Rick and Morty, it's brain candy. I mean, it's just candy. I mean, I savor each one of those episodes, and it's probably my favorite cartoon of all time. And you know, and it really wonderfully explores the medium of cartoons, because it's not a show that pacing you can't do in live action.
No, you can't. And it is, you know, such a great, I love it as just, you know, a commentary on genre writing and an understanding why it's great and why it's amazing and why it can be special and where it can explore things that doesn't necessarily, you know, that you can't do every episode, right? Like if you can't just randomly bounce from place to place in live action. It's so well done, so fun, and the writing on it is also just whip smart. It's great.
What about you, Justin? You got it. You got a pick.
Show us what you got.
We have all here. I would say I'm probably the biggest sports fan amongst the three of us. But yet we can all agree that 30 for 30s, the ESPN documentary series, is certainly worth watching for telling stories that are very interesting, even if you have little to no interest in sports.
Agreed.
Have either of you guys seen, this is a newer one, The Gospel According to Mac?
New.
It is on Netflix right now, and it might be the greatest story. I don't know if it's the greatest 30 for 30. It might be the greatest story that they have ever covered in that series.
Huh. True story, I assume.
true story. Not only does it have all of the sports tropes of coach adversity, you know, forgotten school with bigger rivals, you know, goes through a journey to success, but coach Bill McCartney, you might also know as the founder of the Promise Keepers movement.
I did not know that.
He is a very, very devoutly religious man. Has so many. I'm like on the fence of either do I spoil half this so everybody goes to watch it, or do I just say it's really rad? You should watch. I'll leave it up to you guys, Andrew, Brian. Do you want me to go into some of the interesting parts about it so it hooks everybody, or should
just one? Just give me one tidbit and I'll watch it.
Devoutly religious man recruits a heavily a scouted quarterback that's perfect to run his offense. First year he's in there, he's one of the best in the country. They finally experience some success at this school. The second year, his daughter comes into his bedroom and says, "I am pregnant with the quarterback's baby."
Uh-oh.
The quarterback, and they lay this plain. It's not, they were sneaking around the coach's back because they're in love. Very little interest in the daughter or initially the baby. And so now this devoutly religious man has to publicly deal with the fact that his star quarterback has impregnated his daughter and is very much, you know, doesn't have very interest in marrying her. And now they have to wrestle with what they are going to do with the baby. And that is about 5 minutes of a hour and a half documentary, or maybe it's a little bit shorter, that is just jam packed. He is a very complicated man. He is somebody that was, you know, this is back in the late 80s, early 90s, was using a lot of the language that you see kind of today in terms of understanding what he deemed and said is white privilege toward black people in general and black athletes specifically. You know, it was also very devoutly and loudly against gay people, and you know, it says that the idea of a gay lifestyle is an abomination. A complicated dude that I very, 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 very much recommend everybody watching, including the sports stuff is insane too. One of the craziest sports plays ever happened with this guy during a season that was very, very special and that ended in a very special way. Just insane.
Wow.
Well, gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.